Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in good old Minneapolis. This is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development.
I'm Ellen Burns Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Martha Croy. I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are familiarity and pacing mechanics. And so, if everyone is ready, I went through this very fast. Let's start. The menu keeps it's going still. All right.
I'm ready now. I'm ready now.
I'm not as good as
you,
Ellen.
You really lost your cool there.
I did. I was like, wow, I'm going through this really quickly. And I was like, so everyone's ready. Let's start. And then Ellen, like, sometimes does riffs and stuff. What? But I'm bad at that. Notoriously, whenever we've done, how many episodes is this? Over 300 episodes of this podcast.
This is 357.
Yeah. And notoriously, I every time will have to look at the script to do my line. I'm like, what is my name?
I am Stephen McGregor. He's highlighted here in the notes that are outlined. He's highlighted his name.
Yeah.
Stephen. Yep.
I think it might be the roundtable ones are a little faster.
They are a little faster.
And you haven't done one in 6 weeks.
It's been a little bit, yes. Maybe. So there's that. I think that was a part of it. Like, I wasn't this fast.
And you did the one for last week's, yeah. And you like hit it right on the button because there's a lot to say.
Because it is a lot.
And then you got it in your head. Like, that's how they always go.
Yeah. Because I don't do them very often. And I always get in my head about the intros anyway, so it doesn't make it any better. Well, and anyways, I
nice
did.
Nice games, that close feedback.
Tell Stephen why he's wrong about the intro.
That concludes the inside baseball portion of the program.
Yes. All right. Summer Games Done Quick is happening literally next week. Not Whoa. For people who are listening to this, because this will be out after the...
Yeah, you all missed it.
Yes.
Oops.
But I am going to be there.
Ooh.
Because I went last year and it was fun, and I went the year before.
Are you going to play or just going to watch?
I'm just watching. Okay.
I love how innocent a question that is,
yeah.
And how loaded the answer is.
I'm not that good, Ellen.
Hey, man, you just got to pick an obscure game.
You know, it's kind of fascinating because we know a couple. I actually know two Dylans who have been on the couch.
There is
before.
Too many Dylans in your life.
There are too many Dylans in my life and too many Dylans who have been on the Summer Games Done Quick. It's mm-hmm. really strange.
I think Eric and... friend Adam applied at one point.
Yeah.
Because they were speedrunning.
Yeah, I remember Eric had said something.
Goof Troop.
Right.
Goof Troop. Yeah, that's been on the show plenty of times.
Yeah, yeah.
Fascinating. Any rate, I'm really looking forward to that. I'm actually like half looking forward to it because like I'm going to play a lot of Spirit Island with people. That'll be fun.
Right, because it's a little bit summer campy.
Yeah.
There's all the speedruns that happen on stage that happen 24 hours.
Yep. All day.
All day and all through the night.
Yes.
Which is kind of wild.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's just activities for attendees.
Yes.
Throughout the weekend.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Last year I entered a couple of tournaments. I was in a Smash tournament. I got wrecked. I was in a Kirby Air Ride tournament. I got wrecked. and then, yeah, we played a lot of Spirit Island.
So just Spirit Island. You're not looking forward to getting wrecked at other games?
I looked at the tournaments. None of the tournaments I'm really interested in. There's no Smash tournament, which is, I don't understand.
That's unusual.
There's a Melee tournament, but like, not a Melee tournament.
It doesn't count.
I'm not even in the scene, and I know that that's not how, you would not say that.
I know. Absolutely wouldn't, but I don't play Melee in that way. Outside of that, though, like, there's not a lot of tournaments that I was interested in, so I guess most of my time will likely be watching events. I am interested in watching a few, particularly speedruns, because there are some folks who I watch on Twitch who are going to be there at the event showcasing their games, which would be really fun. And there was like a blindfolded randomizer run. Which, like, I don't even know how that works. They do blindfolded runs before, but, like, how do you do a randomizer run?
I don't know. I think I probably say this every year, but, like, my interest in summer games is always so specific.
Yeah.
And, like, I always want to just watch a random one, and that'll be interesting. And they never are. Mm. I always have to be invested somehow.
No, that's fair.
But, like, you got to have some endurance to, like, put up with more than 10 minutes of a game you've not personally played 100 times.
Yeah, I've watched enough speedruns that like I can kind of get interested in it, and the way that they present it, you know, it's presented very differently from like actually watching a person doing a speedrun on Twitch. It's so weird. They don't explain anything; they just do random stuff, and they're doing a glitch. And you're like, what? And you don't
on Twitch. You mean
on Twitch? Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Because they're just trying to, you know, get the fastest time.
Yeah, the commentators are like the best part.
That makes it that makes it a lot more tenable for people, and so that's why I'm comfortable watching like random.
So recently, not recently, but a while ago, for Noble Engine, the Playdate game engine that I put in, is available open source.
Yeah,
on GitHub, I set up a GitHub sponsors thing where people could donate to support it. Right, which is a thing that you sort of have to do Because if you forget to do it, you're sort of missing out on if someone wants to toss you a couple of bucks.
Yeah.
And GitHub now has a place we could put a bunch of like Ko-fi and a couple other different places to donate. And I did that a long time ago, and then somebody donated. So
hey,
it's just a little milestone. Like that it, just in the past couple of months, there's been a few.
Okay.
That have come up sort of the first time on each of these little platforms.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's very validating.
Yeah. Because
they leave you a little message and they say thanks for it.
Aw.
And it's interesting because like, there's definitely a, I'm kind of, not of two minds exactly, but there's like a whole like a mix of emotions attached to it, which is just like, well, I definitely just made this thing and put it out open source. It was never intended to be any kind of money maker.
Right.
So why do I even want money for it?
Yeah.
Right. And then why do I want, you know, $5 or $10 for it?
Yeah.
Like that feels, it's satisfying, but I actually get enough of that through like the Discord channels that people have devoted to it, and you know, the issue queue and the pull requests. Like it's a relatively active community for a project as small as it is. I'm really proud of it in a lot of ways. And that, I think that's all the satisfaction I need. But then someone kicks you $5 and you're like, oh, that's really nice. And then you're like, but it's $5. It's not really much to sneeze at. It is more the thought that counts in that case.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Part of me like sort of discounts it in a way that I feel like that's not fair. Like they gave me $5. Like
sure,
that's,
sure.
That's a really nice thing they did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's I don't know. It's interesting. I'd be curious to hear from other people who, because you know there are open source projects which drive a lot of donations because they're, you know, big projects where people really, their work relies on it and they're professional and the people will, I've definitely done that. Mm-hmm, open source projects I've used in projects, I'll kick in like $50 to that person.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that's, you know, they did a lot of work for me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That it will be professionally rewarding.
It's like a throwback to the days where you bought software instead of a subscription.
Yeah. And you know, but the open source business model, that's not a proper open source business model for projects, right?
Yeah.
And so it's certainly not for Noble Engine and not really the intent. So it just brought up a lot of things. So I just wanted to kind of mention it. It's kind of what I've been thinking about lately because it's sort of, I don't know, I'm like far enough in my career now that like I have to be like realistic about like what is a satisfying career milestone.
Yeah.
And what is just a really nice thing. Because I think a lot about like how much time am I devoting to maintaining Noble Engine,
right?
And I try to get the pull requests as fast as I can, but it's, you know, I talked about my schedule weeks ago. It's on my Saturday swing day if I've got time for it. I wait for things to pile up a little bit because I can't put a lot more to it. And part of it is because that's not a job I have.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I think about like, well, enough games commercial games have been released for it. Anyway, I don't have much more. I'm kind of running out of steam on this, but like, it is definitely something I've thought about recently because it popped up. And so I went into the Discord community, the channel on the Playdate Squad Discord where people devote to Noble Engine, and I just I acknowledged it. I said like, you know, I didn't use usernames because I think people do like to remain anonymous for things like that.
Yeah.
But I said, you know. Someone did this recently. There's a public thank you. I really appreciate it. And then somebody else, I swear I didn't do it on purpose.
Yeah.
But then someone else kicked me $5.
Aww.
So like, that was very nice as well.
Yeah.
I think that's definitely the case of people. There's sort of a guilt factor I think people have that I might have accidentally triggered. Mm-hmm. But also there's like, sometimes you just need to remind it.
Yeah.
And people do like, especially if it's a small amount, people really enjoy, you know, giving a little bit of money. And I think that there's that angle to it as well that is sort of fascinating. The whole thing is that, big weird like ball of psychological rubber bands. I don't know. And then, you know, less than $100.
Right.
All told.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's been sort of been on my mind lately and just trying to put it straight. I don't quite have my thoughts totally in order on it.
Yeah. Well, you can process that.
Yeah.
Speaking of processing things, the Doctor Who finale came out last week.
From where we're sitting a week ago.
Yes.
So Steven and I have been every Friday this last season of Doctor Who because we do our recording days on Fridays. After the record, we watch the latest episode of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And Ellen, you weren't with us for the last couple of recording sessions, so we couldn't bring you along with. But it's been nice. And last week, you were just busy.
Yeah.
And then last week was the finale.
Yeah, I know.
So you and I have not talked about the finale at all.
Yeah.
So I want to hear your reaction.
I liked it a lot.
Yep.
It felt like a Doctor Who finale in that they just randomly magically solved everything. I was like, all right, that's fine, I guess.
Yep.
So like I wasn't that invested in the actual solution.
Yeah.
I was more invested in like the characters and the emotions and motivations behind it. Mm-hmm. And so like that stuff was more satisfying for me. I actually really liked...
We do a spoiler alert?
Oh, yeah. Spoilers for Doctor Who.
Skip ahead to the first topic time code.
Yeah. But yeah, I really liked how Ruby's mom was the reveal that like she was just like a person, and like the idea of who this person was much more important. Why that solved like the problems.
Yeah.
Like really cool. And I read somewhere that Russell T. Davies like wrote this because he was watching The Last Jedi and was really frustrated with how the sequel to that retconned everything. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yes, because I really liked The Last Jedi. And I was frustrated with that aspect of it too.
Yeah, that was part of the they do commentaries for a couple choice episodes. I watched that one where he says it was his reaction to that. He's like, I really liked it. And then they didn't do it. And I was like, but I liked it.
Yeah.
Well, I'll do it. And I really enjoy how open he is as a creator about his influences.
Yeah.
And in that same commentary, he's like, oh, that's a plot hole. And like, we cut a scene that would have explained that better. But it's still all right, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's just almost as if he's unaware of the legions of like haters online who are picking apart everything.
Yeah.
He does not care.
Yeah.
And he will join them in like poking fun at his own work.
Mm.
Like on release day. Like he's not precious about it. And I really appreciated that as a writer. My reaction very much identical to yours.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I felt pretty much the same way about all that stuff. Yeah. I have almost nothing to add.
Okay. cool.
Yeah, very cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was satisfying, but like I just at this point I've seen enough Doctor Who season finales. Where like you know, they just magically solve a thing. Then I can't get invested in how they solve it.
You also know, like, at the cliffhanger, it's like, I am the god of death. Yeah. Everyone's going to die. I'm like, all right, well, we've got 50 minutes left in the season, so I'm not going to count on it to be that complicated.
Whatever
the fix is.
Exactly.
You know.
Yeah. It all worked out enough for me to feel comfortable with it. If it made literally no sense, which, I mean, sometimes it happens in Doctor Who, then I would be a little more upset.
The Doctor is very comfortable making literally no sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's like, it's not that that's bad. It's that that's the choice they made.
Exactly.
That's makes it very different from Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. No, and I didn't like the episode prior.
Yeah.
Which fans really loved.
Mm.
I thought the cliffhanger was weak and kind of just like a reference, like pointing at the TV.
Yeah.
And so I was really satisfied.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that was short. We didn't have much more to say.
We agree.
Yeah.
Shall we move on to Ellen's topic?
Sure.
Sure.
Let's let Ellen get a word in edgewise.
Well, I haven't watched a lot of Doctor Who, but now I'm kind of like, maybe now's the time. Yeah. So I think, you know, part of the reason Doctor Who is popular, I think, is because he's very familiar.
That's brilliant.
Pretty good.
You guys, you appreciate it for 3 seconds, and you give me, it's pretty good. anyway, so the one thing has not changed in the last few months is that I have very little extra time right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's starting to change. I'm starting to get things, I think, kind of smoothed out and figured out. But I haven't really gotten into playing any big games. I haven't touched Baldur's Gate, which is crazy. It's like basically my game time is like D&D on Wednesdays, and then occasionally I will play Flappy Dragon again.
So I do
occasionally just like mobile games if I'm not in a place where I can get big chunks of time to spend on PC or whatever, because I like to really like settle in and focus on big session if I'm in that kind of space. But a lot of mobile games are more casual in their design, so they're intended for shorter play sessions if you want to keep them that way. And so I went through a couple more mobile games over the last few months, and then I was like, oh, I wonder what's going on with Flappy Dragon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I go back in there, they have more dragons.
Shocker. I'm shocked.
They have more dragons that I don't have, right?
That makes it worse.
The last time I played as Flappy Dragon, I got all the dragons.
Yeah.
And that was good.
I was under the impression you had beat that game, in fact.
Well, that's what it meant.
Yeah.
We'll get into that.
Okay.
It got unbeat.
That's exactly what happened. It got unbeaten because they added more content and I hadn't gone through it. And the content in this...
Content?
Yeah, I was going to say content is really just like different dragons that fly slightly differently and look slightly differently.
Yeah.
But I want them all. So I've been playing that again.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a little bit kind of like having a Tamagotchi pet. You come back like, oh, hey, I'm going to fly with you today. It's going to be fine. Let's go knock down some towers and eat some people.
Forget how this game works. Like, oh, yeah. It's not so cute.
Yeah.
It's very cute. And lots of implied sparkly violence. Like, I'm so excited to use my firepower and burn literally everything. Yeah, so it's, it was interesting because, I didn't get drawn back into the game until they you know, moved the goalpost on me.
Yeah.
But going back and playing it some more is not, that's not something I've often done in the past. Mm. And so it was interesting to see like my reaction as a player in the kind of this different context of life where I don't have as much time or brain space to like dedicate to big games, mm-hmm. yeah. to big sit down games. I don't like replaying games very much. There's only been a couple games that I've replayed. Even when I've replayed those after I completely explored every nook and cranny on like a second or third playthrough, I still have a really good memory of Night in the Woods. And I love that game a lot, and I love the music, but I don't have any urge to go back and replay it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, because sometimes I want to go back and like reread novels, but I don't really replay games, which is interesting. I don't know what the deal is there, but I have wanted to go back and play Flappy Dragon, and now it's like part of like a routine almost. Like, okay, it's the end of the day, flap some dragons around,
yeah,
and then go to bed.
Yeah.
And it's like it's not so much of a cozy game, because it's like, you know, it's a Flappy Bird clone. You got to really be focused and you're pressing the button, but not for very long. And then you die fast. And that's fine. So it's not like, I would say, super relaxing. Yeah. But it's very familiar. And I thought that familiarity is, I think, one of the things that's drawing me back to it. And that's not something that I've really sought out in lots of games before. So I yeah. wanted to bring that up, because I think my thesis is that this element of familiarity is something that can happen with any game that you play.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily a thing that's only for cozy games or only for casual games. I think it can be developed in any game with enough exposure and practice in that game.
Actually, this is helping me help define this concept for me, because I think that like people will go back, they'll talk about like, oh, I'll go back to Dark Souls and play through that game because like, you know, that's their familiar game, mm-hmm. and like they feel comfortable with it at this point. And so mm-hmm. like they go back to that one because it doesn't take a lot of effort for them, because they put in a bunch of effort into it already, and now mm-hmm. they understand how the game works. And it's something that like they know, so they can get through it in a way that like feels comfortable, mm-hmm. but like it's still like something to do. The way you're describing the Flappy Dragon, and frankly the way that you've always described Flappy Dragon, is that it's like, you know, it doesn't take a lot of effort, you just kind of like go through the motions a lot of the time, and I think that's how people will approach like something like Dark Souls. It's just something that like takes up some time, mm-hmm. that like entertains them enough for the amount of time that they play it, and it's not necessarily something they're not looking to get anything else more out of it other than an activity.
There is something interesting there, and that. But you're getting at the thing that I really wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
I think that any game can develop a like this draw of familiarity.
Okay.
Whether it's a difficult game or a not very difficult game.
Sure. Yeah, for sure.
I think casual games are potentially designed in a way to kind of fast track that feeling.
Mm.
But I think with enough practice, you can get good enough at a game that the challenge isn't necessarily the point anymore.
Well, I guess that was kind of where my theory was going to end up going, is because like I think what happens is like you just put in enough effort for a game where it just feels comfortable, and it's like a habit mm-hmm. that you're doing it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of what you hit with Flappy Dragon mm-hmm. more, and what other people have experienced with other games.
Yeah.
Because like it doesn't have to be Dark Souls. I think people also like experience this stuff with like Animal Crossing.
Yeah.
Which is not a difficult game. Mechanically,
yeah,
but like you just spend a lot of time in it,
yeah,
and since you spent a lot of time in it, it becomes familiar and you're just comfortable spending more time in it, and it doesn't take a lot of effort for you to do the routine things you do in that game.
Mm-hmm.
And Animal Crossing is designed for you to do routine things. I think that is a good example of something that's kind of designed to be familiar,
yeah,
in a way that Dark Souls ends up being potentially for people, but isn't exactly the intention.
So yeah,
that's interesting. But I guess I would argue that I don't think that every game really has that like familiarity hook, or like any game can be familiar to someone. You can spend enough time in something, you can spend 10,000 hours in any game, right? If you want and you try really hard. But I think some games are just like more prone to this kind of concept.
Yes, and that's where I wanted to go to next.
Okay,
the last thing I'll put on the previous one is like one example that isn't Flappy Dragon for me,
yeah,
is like Super Metroid.
Okay, yeah.
And I have played the nonsense out of that game. Mm-hmm. And I think Dread would do this for me, too, if I wanted to revisit that. I think it would quickly get to that point for me.
Yeah.
And that is, like, even if you have a really big map, like, you play it enough and you get familiar enough with the move. I think it's like the state of flow,
yeah,
honestly, you know, if you're familiar with that term.
Yeah, I mean, yes, but I think it's as much about you turning the discovery and skill checking and challenge into just pattern recognition.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Right? Yeah.
I mean, I guess we're not talking about that much different things.
No, maybe not, but that's okay. Finish your thought.
Yeah, it just seems like, yeah, you said, Stephen, not all games are designed for this.
Right.
But the human brain can turn anything into it.
Yes.
I think.
Yes.
It kind of just depends. Like people, like Tetris is a game you get that state of flow in. But separately, you could, and this is the one for me, is like solitaire games can be not challenging. I just like, I know all the meta of the various solitaire games I play, and I can just kind of do them.
Right.
And I don't have a lot of, I don't feel a lot of reward for winning a hand.
Yeah.
And I don't feel a lot of frustration in losing one.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I just kind of know how it works and I go through the motions.
Yeah.
And that is ostensibly a more casual game, but it's all of its mechanics are skill checks and stuff like that. But it ends up just being about like just turning the crank. Mm-hmm. And so it's easier to do it for a game like that because the onboarding to that path is way easier. But then on Dark Souls, which is just very much a game of like, you know, brutally checking against your reflexes.
Right, right.
But when you've done it enough,
and
it's not that anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and that's why I think Dark Souls in particular is conducive to that, is because like you spend so much time dealing with all these bosses, fighting these enemies, understanding how the mechanics work, because that's the only way to get through the game, that you've done it so much, it's familiar for you, and you can just go through it again and just go through the motions, for the most part. I'm sure there are some bosses that are still, you still have to like pay attention to, I guess, but like after a while, you know, it just becomes second nature because you're just so accustomed to it.
Do you think the predictability of like, say, an opponent or a scenario is helpful for that? So you have a game like Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, which is extremely predictable.
Yes.
That's one of its strengths.
Yeah.
So getting good at it is really about building up a practice.
Yeah.
Whereas like fighting games, even against a computer opponent, which are fairly dumb, are generally about contextual familiarity.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't as easily, but do you think you can just as easily reach that, even though all the outcomes are not as determined by your experience?
That is a very good question. I have an answer, but I want Ellen to answer first. If you have an opinion.
I want to hear your answer because I don't think I understood the question.
Oh, okay. I think what Mark was asking is like, can you experience this kind of familiarity in like a competitive multiplayer game? Such as a fighting game or League of Legends or what have you.
Well, a game where, you kind of, you're not as in control. You're less and less control of the outcomes, either randomly or by the presence of other players.
Right. Yeah, that's fair. I'm thinking about it in terms of like my multiplayer experiences. And I know that like people will go to like League of Legends to try to feel that sense of familiarity that I think we're describing here, but like we'll bump up against the fact that like they actually have to pay attention because the opponents are not just AI. Also their teammates might be obnoxious, and there's that aspect of it too. even in a fighting game, I have tried to do that with like Super Smash Bros. Ultimate, right? Is I'll like go into the game and I'll be like, I'm familiar with this game. I like playing it, and I would like to play some matches. And then I will go in and do some of these matches.
The politest approach to a fighting game.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, is this where the fisticuffs occur?
Oh, that's great.
That's the episode title.
And so, like, I'll start up a game of Smash, and then I'll get beat down. And then I'll be like, well, okay, this isn't exactly what I intended to sign up for, but of course I'm going to get beat down because some players are just going to be better than me. And so it ends up not feeling familiar because it feels familiar because, like, I'm playing Kirby and I'm used to that. But, like, it doesn't feel familiar because, like, I'm dealing with a particularly hard matchup, or I don't want to fight Samus this time or something, you know?
Understandable.
Yeah. Man, Samus Kirby matchup is not great. One of my friends, like, every time we meet, we were always like, want to play Smash? I'm like, okay. And then I have to go against Samus and it sucks.
Right, you have to because you cannot play anyone other than Kirby.
Right, because you have to play Kirby. So you're trapped.
I do play a little Mac, but that's not any better. Anyway, so I think that, like, multiplayer games kind of have a harder time with this, but I think people will approach games in that same vein, looking for that sense of familiarity, for something to do.
Yeah.
But like, you can't, it won't, I think a lot of times it doesn't hit that what you're looking for sense, I guess.
It makes me interested. I feel like I need to do some reading and maybe do a coda on this episode, but kind of observing this, like this drive for familiarity makes me think of like the term ritual.
Yeah.
Because it's not the challenge anymore, per se. I mean, there's an element to that, but it's such a familiar challenge that it doesn't carry like the same like feelings that a new challenge does, or something that's freshly, you're freshly competent at it. You're very competent at it. Mm-hmm. And it's very, you know, the framework of the challenge is very familiar. You understand exactly where the bosses are going to be, and you're getting the satisfaction of like being able to just kind of seamlessly execute these actions in pursuit of whatever the near term goal is.
Yeah.
And that is like flow state, right? Mm-hmm. But I think the overall act of like, okay, it's this part of my day, I'm gonna pick up this game and I'm gonna do this thing. There's like a ritualistic element to it. Mm-hmm. And I think that ritualistic element is like self-soothing in a way. So maybe it's not so much entertainment, but it is kind of like a self-soothing, like maybe meditative is not really the right word, but it's that kind of like ritualistic behavior that can be gratifying at certain points. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, and I think people can find that kind of ritualistic behavior satisfying even when it's involving other people that are creating a more chaotic experience.
Yeah.
So it makes sense to me that that would be like a habit or a pattern that people will get into even with multiplayer games.
Yeah.
Multiplayer competitive games. I was just thinking, like, my brother-in-law plays so much Destiny. Mm. And he does it like the same time every day. And he gets on with his friends, and like that's collaborative. Mm-hmm. But it is, I think there is like a ritualistic element to it. And the interesting thing is like, yeah, is it something that you design for? Because I don't think it's just about replayability.
Yeah. As we've discussed it, it is ultimately, and I mean, the limits of it, we haven't fully been able to discover because that takes testing. But
right.
It seems like it doesn't really matter what the game is.
Yeah.
Like in a broad sense. It's the feeling you go for, and you can get that through any activity,
mm-hmm.
Whether that's just tending a Zen garden or playing Destiny.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, designing for it is a question. I think it's like, how do you evaluate your game's conduciveness to that path?
Yeah.
And is it something you should even be thinking about?
Yeah, that's the question.
If you're making a casual game, then that's part of your monetization strategy explicitly.
Yeah.
So that's its own thing. Maybe even not monetization, but certainly the success of the game, right? If you want people to spend time in
it. That's how Animal Crossing works.
Yeah. Animal Crossing said the point is you want people to spend time in it.
Right.
So whether that's for nefarious purposes or for charming ones is outside the scope of this topic.
Yeah.
But you design for that. But at the same time, I don't know if you have to. My question then is, is it something you need to worry about if you say don't want that to happen? If you want to keep things, people on their toes and fresh, but then I don't know what developer would actually want that. I don't know necessarily.
For the reasons you're bringing up, like I know that it's sort of beyond the scope of this topic, but like if you want the game to feel like an event, an experience in the moment, then you don't want this sense of familiarity. Like, I mean, there are plenty of like 3-hour long narrative experiences that like people go through. Mm-hmm. That they don't want, need or want to, because it's happened and that's the experience.
Yeah.
Journey, for instance, right? Like
to the moon
or to the moon. Oh my gosh, I'm not playing that game.
Nope.
Like those kinds of games, like you had that experience and you don't want to do that. I think that like you don't necessarily design to be anti-familiarity. Mm-hmm. You just design this particular experience, and I think that like players won't want that, at least for a while.
Well, I actually the dimension that has brought up then is a narrative, right?
Okay,
You know, we've talked about this in a previous episode, like the end of a game, aka the end of a story.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be a story told, you know, in a standard format, but can be told in any way.
Yeah.
Then you're right. Yeah, a game that has an ending, you really would only revisit the same way you'd revisit a television show.
Right.
But some of the same emotions apply in that case, I suppose.
Yeah.
If there's like an open-ended sort of ritual to it, you wouldn't necessarily ever expect that from a Gone Home or something like that.
Right.
Right. Like there's certainly certain types of games that are very simple to master, because that's not the point, would be very mechanically inducive to you being able to replay them over and over again.
Right.
And scratch that kind of itch literally.
Mm-hmm.
But then the presentation, including sort of narrative and requiring your attention on that level, takes you out of that feeling, perhaps.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Maybe why Dark Souls works, but like you wouldn't necessarily, you probably would hear that a lot less from people talking about Assassin's Creed.
Sure.
Even the big open worldy ones.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
You know?
Mm-hmm. I see what you're saying.
I was thinking there might be an inverse relationship between like the difficulty of gameplay and narrative somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I was thinking about this is because again, this is based on my own experience, I don't mind rereading novels.
Right.
And that's, I think it's because there's just so, first of all, it's not a system. It's just a story.
Yeah.
And there's often just so many details and you're rendering how it looks in your head as you're reading it. Whereas with the game, you are not rendering it all in your head. You're really immersed in experiencing and interacting with the system. Mm-hmm. And that feeling of interacting with the system is rewarding in and of itself. And so going back to a familiar game, you're able to recapture that feeling without, you know, the feeling of interacting with the system that's really rewarding without necessarily needing to re-engage with the narrative, because it's not necessarily the narrative that you're trying to, that you're coming back to. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know if listeners like it when we kind of just explore topics that maybe don't have good answers. But like,
that's like all of our.
I know. But like,
I think they like it at this point.
Maybe someone out there is thinking about their master's thesis and now they've got something to think about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey. You're welcome. Anyway. Yeah. So, yeah, I want to come back and ask this in some metas in the next few episodes, just like see if we can observe this feeling of like seeking familiarity or like ritualistic play.
I'm sure it'll come back up because you're still playing Flappy Dragon.
So. I can't stop. I still have like three at least to catch.
Also, I mean, who's to say? I mean, I can't imagine they would, but they might release more dragons.
Oh, no.
I'm trapped.
Yeah. So we have a nice Games Club t-shirt.
Mm-hmm. I've got one.
Yeah, we all have one, I think, at this point.
I hope.
I know I do.
Yeah, Ellen, you're not special.
Yeah, gosh. You can go to nicegames.club/shirt if you would like to feel special.
As special as we are, anyway.
As special as us.
But not me. I'm not.
Not Ellen.
You can be.
But Mark, I wanted you to talk about the logo design.
Yes. So, quick primer, because you've opened up the floodgates.
Oh, no.
But the original logo for the show was designed relatively quickly back in 2016.
Yeah.
Gulp.
Oh, wow.
For the show.
Yeah.
And the color pattern was very bright and neon, sort of like earth tone neon is kind of what we went with.
Yeah.
Which I really liked, but I think we lost tolerance for it eventually. And we talked about a little while that we wanted to change the logo. And we've now lived with the new one, I think, longer than the old one.
Yeah.
For certain.
I actually barely remember the first one.
Yeah. Well, but you, Martha, and I, and Dale, we all got together and we did kind of a little bit of a workshop. I came up with some concepts and we sort of picked I treated the rest of you like a client.
Yeah.
And we talked a lot about what we wanted the logo to say and what we wanted to mean. And so you can see that the way it is it's sort of like an object bracket that contains three things in it, which is the three hosts, represented by three colors, which is actually something we do a lot internally in the show when we color code things in our documents and in our recordings.
Yeah.
It's not really that important to listeners. It sort of works for us in the way we run the show. And that also bleeds into the new website as well.
Yeah.
That has sort of color codes for a lot of things. And so color coding became sort of a part of our brand for our different episode types and for all these sorts of things as well. And we wanted something that was simple, that evoked a sense of construction, but also, like, you know, it is an object that mattered to us. But it was really nice to sort of, like, decide what the show was. And then pretty soon after, we made the t-shirt.
Yeah.
Because it was a way of being like, well, now we have this thing that represents us, but we're this audio medium. Like, how...
People aren't going to recognize.
We have a website. You see the logo in your podcast app. But, like, it's a visual thing. And so we wanted to make it, you know, visually available to people.
Yeah.
And so that's my segue into saying we put on a t-shirt.
Yes. Well, I think listeners will appreciate just understanding, like, the thought process behind that logo.
Yeah.
That is on the shirt that hopefully you will purchase. So if you go to nicegames.club/shirt, you can get a shirt of your own. See the logo and everything.
Okay, so Ellen, you left us hanging a little bit on that last topic, and you say maybe we'll revisit it, you know, sometime down the way. Mm-hmm. But actually, my topic I think is a better it feels better now than maybe when we put it in this order, but I feel like it's a good follow-on. We can kind of keep talking about this.
Okay.
Because my topic is pacing mechanics.
Yeah.
And we've talked on the show in a previous episode, and we'll put that in the show notes, narrative mechanics.
Yeah.
Narrative pacing.
Yeah.
Steven, that was one of your topics.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked a lot about like how story is delivered. I think we talked about the length, the oppressive length of
games. Yeah, this was one of my complaining episodes.
Yeah. A classic Steven complainer.
Uh-huh.
Love it. But I wanted to talk about it a little bit just from the mechanical side.
Yeah.
Partly because I'm playing Paper Mario Thousand Year Door, which is a game that I didn't play it when it originally came out, but it's one of my favorite games.
Yeah.
Or at least that's what I would always say when people say, what's your favorite game? It's just sort of an easy answer for me because it was a big surprise to me. Like, I like Mario games. I'm RPGs, I could like give or take more or less. I like the mechanics, but they're all way too long.
Mm.
So I haven't played a ton of them. But when I got a Wii, there wasn't a lot of games out, and
yeah. You
couldn't find them in stores anyway.
Yeah.
And so I bought a bunch of old GameCube games, and that was one of them.
Cool.
And I fell in love with this game, and I was like, oh, the story's so interesting, and it has the lightness of a Mario, but also has the sort of depth of character in a way that doesn't take itself too seriously. It takes itself the right amount of serious. I loved a lot about it.
Yeah.
So remember, the big remaster came out some weeks ago. And I'm like a third of the way through it. I'm going through it very slowly.
Okay.
Everyone else is finished with it by now.
Yeah.
And by the time this episode is out, everybody. One of the things that is slowing me down a little bit is the sort of the whole JRPG-ness of it.
Yeah.
Which is just the walk five screens over, look at a thing, walk back, talk to a person. You know what I mean? There's a lot of just going places and pressing A.
Yeah.
That works best when you don't know where you're going, you're given a clue.
Right.
But at the same time, the game is really forgiving about giving you those answers or offering them to you.
Yeah.
And so it is not a very challenging game.
Right.
I wouldn't say. I think the most challenging part about it is like battle mechanics and planning for battles and stocking up and all the normal battle stuff.
Yeah.
But the most interesting part to me is those overground sort of tasks. But then there's just tons of walking around.
Yeah.
And this should not surprise me. that's how these games work.
Yeah.
And it's also maybe a little bit less these days. They added this mechanic in the game where you have this like a room full of warp pipes that'll take you to all the worlds you visited.
Yeah.
And that's like a big time saver, but you're still doing a ton of walking around. It doesn't actually save you that much time.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk about it because I'm falling out of love with it a little
bit.
Oh,
no.
I'm not, that's not okay. I don't mind that.
Yeah. Okay.
But it's definitely like, I'm definitely, 15 years older now.
Yeah.
This is the last time I played it.
Sure.
So like I have less patience for this kind of thing because I know how it's going to go.
Right.
And part of that is that familiarity of walking around the town.
Yeah.
And talking to everybody along the way.
Right.
Maybe they have something new to say and not really taking your time that seriously.
Yeah.
That's really fun it feels very Animal Crossing until you go to the battle. Right.
Yeah.
Where you're just walking around enjoying the sights. Oh, there's a new NPC. Let me talk to them and, page through 30 speech bubbles just to get to four jokes.
Yeah.
Like, let's see what Luigi's up to.
I mean, that part's fun.
It's funny. Luigi is on his own side adventure, which is hilarious.
Yeah.
After every world you complete, you see him in the town square and he tells you about the piece of the magical compass that he got this time.
Yeah.
Which is funny. And but he always, every time you talk to him, he goes, this is going to take a while. Is that okay? Because it's actually sensitive for the player's time.
Yeah.
Oh, side note, I have a complaint about that.
Oh.
Which is every time Luigi comes back to town and you talk to him and you hear about his side adventure, which is very parallel to what you're doing, which is what's funny about it, he also brings a new sidekick with him because you get a new sidekick for every mission, right?
Yeah.
Every world. And and you talk to the sidekick and they always deflate Luigi's story.
Yeah.
So Luigi always talks about like, oh, brother, you wouldn't believe it. I was so scared, but then I came through and I rescued this and then I got the thing and it was incredible.
Yeah.
And like that alone is funny.
Yeah.
And then you talk to his companion and they say, oh, this dupe just tripped over everything and caused a bunch of problems. It's amazing we got it. And part of that is like, that's so mean as a storytelling mechanic. And maybe because I like Luigi so much.
Yeah, that's fair.
But also it just like, I also don't, Luigi is a bit of a, he's a sweetie.
Yeah.
He's an innocent and a little ignorant, or naive perhaps,
is
how he's been depicted in a lot of games. But this makes him into kind of like not almost a villain. in a way that I thought was weird. I didn't. Anyway, sidebar over.
I do kind of remember that, but yeah.
I remember like, oh, right, Luigi's silly adventure, and like, oh, he's stumbling through this adventure, and like, it's cool, and he's getting his compass, and oh, he's skin of his teeth, and he's not really a Mario. He's a Luigi.
Yeah.
And then you talk to his sidekick, and the sidekick's like, this guy sucks. And it's like, what the? Come on.
He's doing his best.
It's like everywhere he goes, people are mad at him for what he's done. And I'm like, what? What is the point of this?
Yeah.
Like, I just felt very, I was struck by that in a way it wasn't the last time I played it. Anyway, sidebar properly over now.
All right.
But a lot of it is because you spend a lot of your time just absorbing the things in the game.
Right.
And so the pacing of it is, I guess this is, it's definitely, I mean, obviously it's by design, but like there are, it speeds up and slows down in a way that I completely did not remember.
Okay.
And I'm like, I guess that just must be a genre convention, actually. Sometimes you are just stuck with nothing to do,
yeah.
And you could start the next big part of the chapter, but you're going to spend some time mopping up some side things,
yeah.
And that's going to take a while because they're scattered to the wind,
right?
And you got a new ability, so you got to go back to some old areas to see some things you missed,
yeah.
And so that is just that's a very slow process, and because that is attractive in that moment, because when it's time to move on to the next chapter, none of that is familiar to you.
Right.
It's starting a brand new thing.
Yeah.
But now you have new context for the things you're familiar with. And so you can kind of, and you have all the skills, you know, where all the enemies are. Mm. You're powered up now, so they stand no chance against you. Mm-hmm. So you're very motivated to do a lot of that.
Yeah.
But then that slows you down a lot.
Yes.
In a way that I don't know is intentional. Because there's definitely the thing everyone knows, which is, do you go on the main quest or do you do every side mission before the next thing?
Yeah.
I'm definitely the second type of person.
Sure.
But I think if you don't do a lot of that stuff, the game is harder because you don't level up.
You're not leveling
up. You don't level up as fast.
Right. That is intentional.
And that's, so there's definitely, that is designed in a bit for you to sort of find a middle ground. But I don't think anyone plays the middle ground in any video game.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like people are like one type or the other. There's very little balance to be had in most people's play style. This is a supposition. You know, nicegames.club/discord. One of the people say games are too long because not just because they are too long,
but
because people are compelled to get
do all the
content.
Stuff.
Right.
Yeah. It's so frustrating to be in a game that's taking too long, but you can't bring yourself to make it shorter, even though it's within your power.
Totally get that.
And that's definitely a case here.
Yeah.
Because when you move on from that thing, you're going to forget the context
and
of who to talk to.
Yeah.
So you got to do it now. Otherwise, it's going to take even longer when you get back to it.
Yeah.
And so, man, this is turning into a Steven complainer. but it dovetails pretty well, Ellen, with your topic of like what can slow down a game is that sense of just wanting to stick around where you are. The angle on it I want to approach is developer motivations.
Yeah.
So in Dream Settler, we're designing this fake operating system. We have mini games. We have a whole website to browse.
Yeah.
You can spend tons of time just browsing, and we're very much designing it to be a place to hang out in.
Right.
This is a very, like, that type of game design, even though it was not unfamiliar as we got going, it's different from anything I've ever done.
Mm.
And I've long been an advocate of shorter games. And precisely paced games.
Yeah.
Like that is that's valuable to me. And as games mature as a medium, I think the you can do anything for as long as you want needs to fall out of favor.
Mm.
But I'm designing a game where you can do anything you want for as long as you want.
Yeah.
Right. And
sure.
So there's irony there, but I don't think I'm a hypocrite.
No, I think you're exploring what that is and why you don't like it.
Yeah, and we also need to think about how we motivate the player to move on,
right?
And how we tell them it's okay to stop to take a break, from the main area, and not let them get lost in one of our super fun mini games, Or we have to decide that it's okay to get lost in a super fun mini game because it can be something you come back to. Because, you know, spoiler alert, we're going to have, like, solitaire-type games.
Yeah.
And, right, right.
And I like those kinds of games for what they are. I don't need the solitaire game to take less of my time.
Right.
I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
And we have those types of experiences in this game. And so you can sort of mode switch.
Yeah.
And that's a strength of the first game of Hypnospace Outlaw. And so we don't want to lose that. But there's definitely a tension there. I have no idea how to playtest for that.
Yeah.
Because you have to, like, put it in front of people for a long time.
Yeah, I don't even know how you tune. Like,
and we're not going to get to that point for a long time because it's the whole of it is going to be what needs to be tested.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to go on blind faith a little bit for some of it. We're going to be able to test components, but the intersection of all of it. And so, things like RPGs, open world games, things where there's lots to do.
Yeah.
Or things where you're motivated to either get back onto the main path or step away from the main path. I think of like Spider-Man.
Yeah.
I definitely will mop up all the side missions as I go, just in all games. But in Spider-Man, I did that. But every now and again, you tell what it was designed for, which is it's designed for that middle ground that nobody does. But then what will happen every now and again is that you'll hear Spider-Man talk to himself and say, well, nothing to do. I better go patrol.
Yeah.
Like he'll say that to literally tell the player, don't worry. That we're not, the main quest is on hold for a while until you do some other stuff.
Yeah.
That's much more hand-holdy in the way it handles it. And I, even though I only see that a couple of times throughout my playthrough of a game like that, I appreciate that it sets those limits on
Yeah.
you. That it says anyone trying to blast through the main campaign, it says, nope, that's not how this game works. You should play more of this game.
Yeah.
In order to get the proper experience. And for people like me who like burn through all of it, it's still like, there's not so much side content in that game that you would never want to go back to the main quest. And so that, I feel that's a good example, but mm-hmm. also there's a lot to do in a Spider-Man game.
Right.
By the standards of open world games, there's not a lot to do.
Mm. Okay.
And that's a virtue, but is it just a matter of quantity? Do you just want less to do and then players can find that balance better?
Yeah, this is a very deep question.
Uh-huh. Sorry.
No, it's fine. initially when you were bringing up the idea, like talking about like the traditional way that turn-based RPGs are designed, and that there's not really people play it one of two ways. Either they play through all the content or they skip all of it and play just the main story thing. I feel like initially games, JRPGs in particular, were not designed in that way.
Yeah.
And I think they were in fact designed so that like you had to bump up against, there will be walls where you have to do side content because the game, you either have to get extremely good at the strategy of the game or the game basically won't allow you to go progress unless you get some more levels.
Yeah.
And it's boring to just fight the same, I don't know any Dragon Quest. It's boring to fight the same slimes over and over again. So you feel motivated to go do other side quests because those have some more narrative plot to them.
Right.
This
is a little bit of what Ron Gilbert was talking about
yes.
in our recent interview with him about roadblocks.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. 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 Right. Yeah. So like, he used puzzles as a mechanic. I think previous old JRPGs had like effectively grinding, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Not effectively. It was.
And sometimes it would be like you didn't get an item.
Yeah.
Whatever,
or something
found somewhere.
Yeah. That's
so
true. They would do
kind of like point and click puzzles in a sense. Yeah.
Lock and key. But I think that like as games have progressed, we've like moved away from like that kind of a mechanic thing. And so like games are generally speaking easy enough for players to just go through without having to go back and do the side quests.
Yeah.
But people still want to do all the side quests because they want all that narrative content.
There's
and
a
so, like
a
it breaks some of that.
Developers have a kind of please the user motivation.
Yes.
They don't want to frustrate them too much.
Right.
That's one of the reasons why games are pretty easy now.
Yeah.
Even the hardest game you've played in the last 15 years is pretty easy.
It's not that bad. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if that's just something that people need to have the courage to go back to, because I think things get a little bit muddier. Maybe?
It still doesn't. I mean, ultimately, it still doesn't solve the problem that I think you were describing, in that like you still feel motivated to do all the content.
Yeah.
And so the grinding or what have you does not impact your experience at all.
Really. I suppose so. It caps it on one end, but not the other.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't think it solves that issue. And I don't necessarily know how to solve that issue unless you put like a time pressure on in the game or something like that.
Yeah.
Players don't like that, but whatever. I don't care.
What do we care what players want?
I know.
They say they don't like it.
Yeah.
And then
they keep playing them.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So like that, I mean, that's just an example of some way to like maybe get players to experience certain parts of the game, but not necessarily all of it, prioritizing it, you know,
yeah.
instead of just getting everything. Because, you know, I've been experiencing this as well for myself.
Mm-hmm.
The second playthrough of Dragon's Dogma 2 that I had, I like started looking up more stuff because I was like, I didn't find like the Sphinx is a big part of like a lot of the trailers and stuff. And I was like, I couldn't find where she even was. So like I had to look it up and I couldn't figure it out.
Yeah.
And as I was doing that, I like opened the floodgates. And so I started just looking up a bunch of all the different side content and just like kind of starting to do it like a checkbox.
Yeah.
And it started being frustrating because I was like, I'm not playing the game the way I want to play, and I'm playing the game because I'm playing the game in a checkboxy manner. I don't want to play Dragon's Dogma that way.
And the ideal of that kind of development is to make the world so big that it feels like it's endless.
Yeah.
But no gamer ever believes that.
Right.
They look for that checklist.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think... and
people, they don't really want you to play everything.
Right. Exactly. And I foolishly read the Dragon's Dogma 2 Reddit. Should not be doing this.
Can't escape.
But I just really want to read about the game. Anyways, and people are like frustrated with the idea that like they can't find the quest givers to get them this quest, so they're missing out on content. And I'm like, that's okay. You don't have to see all the content. But they're like frustrated.
Thank you, lucky
stars. Yeah, but they're like frustrated that like there's not a little exclamation point on a person to tell you to talk to this person so you can get this quest so you can go do the things.
Yeah.
And so it just feels like they're missing out on things. And I think the environment of games has changed. So I think you're right in that the environment of games have changed to make this more of an issue. Because like, you know, Dragon's Dogma and Dragon's Dogma 2 aren't so different, but I was definitely playing the first game differently than how I'm playing the second game, just due to the fact that like I've had 15 years of different experiences that colored how I'm experiencing this game.
Yeah.
And maybe how it was designed a bit too, but like for the most part, not that big of a difference as far as I'm concerned. Mm. So I think that was like a culture shift that made it difficult. Yeah. That makes it difficult to like convince people. Plus, like everybody, people have more access to guides. It's difficult to even just like resist that urge. I didn't resist.
Yeah,
that
it's
urge.
Kind of impossible to hide anything.
Yeah,
anything
yeah,
yeah.
So I've actually been thinking about this too myself. Is like, how do you like convince players to not see all the content, or convince players to like allow themselves to miss, to allow themselves to like struggle against like trying to solve this puzzle without having to look it up?
Well, it's with regard to pacing, it's the user story. It's like if you let the players decide for themselves what the pacing is, then it's going to be bad.
Yeah.
Like, or at least it's not going to be deliberate.
That's
either going to be sort of like endless and monotonous, which is satisfying and familiar in a lot of ways, right? Mm-hmm. So there's something nice about that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the side where if that happens in some of our Dream Settler content, like that's the side we're kind of okay with. Like you can, long after you've played the story, you can load up the game, open one of the mini games and play that as long as you like.
Yeah.
Like that's sort of, that's core to the thing. But at the same time, do we want players in the middle of their story playthrough to just get off the train and then play one of our mini games for 3 weeks?
Because then they'll miss out on, they'll miss the train.
Well, when they get back on the story, what will their mind space be? Will they remember a certain thing? And what is our job?
Right.
And is it not our job? Because maybe it's not.
Yeah.
Like I've advocated on the show before for like the developer's hand is in this stuff is very important for the medium to grow.
Yeah.
Is for us to actually say more with what we do and not just let the players do what they want and choices matter. It's like great, but what do they mean?
Yeah.
And so, but it's tricky because players are also perfectly happy to have the hand off the wheel and they can do and discover on their own because that is nice. It's a really good experience for players. So letting go of that is a virtue in one respect, if not the one I'm talking about necessarily. You lose control of the pacing. It's totally up to the player now, and so you have to hint them, but you can't be too forceful. And when is it time to just say, like, it's like time to move on, this is the next thing is happening? Like, without them, either you could be very deliberate about it. It's like it's time, you know, a timer, like you said. Forgetting whether that, assuming you can make that feel good for the player.
Yeah.
Like, is there time to sort of like let the air out?
Yeah.
And do you do it deliberately, like the way that like Spider-Man sort of does it? But at the same time, you can tell that it's still, it doesn't have the freedoms that a lot of games can have when they let their hand further off.
It depends. I think there's no answer that is universal, right? It really depends on what experience you're trying to create.
Sure.
Yeah.
But I like the way that you're talking about it because I think it emphasizes the fact that like so many other parts of gameplay, the pacing is a conversation that is unfolding between the design and the player.
Yeah.
Right. Well, the design and the player, I guess. And so if you, just within a conversation, like you can't have it all be one-sided. That's not a conversation. That's a lecture.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a really good way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you also can't necessarily put it all in the player's control, 'cause then it's just the reverse.
Yeah.
Right. Then you've given them a toy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like,
which is like fine.
which is fine.
But I think a lot of developers don't know they're doing that.
Yeah, that's all I was going to say.
It potentially hurt the game if you don't know you're doing it right.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah. Maybe you're making a game that is a toy, and that's fine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But like...
Yeah, we're pro toy here on the show.
True,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Toys are fun.
Mm-hmm.
We like fun on Nice Games Club. Uh-huh. Cool. All right, I'm glad we decided that for the record to let it be known.
You were wrong then. You do have an answer for us of some kind.
Yeah, I guess. Oops.
So, okay, this is really interesting because I'm recognizing, you know, all the complaints that I had in the pacing episode from before.
Yeah.
And that, like, I was frustrated with how games are bad at pacing and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But I'm starting to recognize that, like, one of the things is that it's sort of lopsided because players have a bunch of tools that are outside of the developer's control to influence the pacing.
Yeah.
Because they could just look up stuff. They can, you know, chat on wherever gamers are chatting.
They can pause the game and come back 9 months later.
Well, there's that too. Yeah. But, like, that's always been a thing. I'm talking about, like...
It hasn't always been a thing.
Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry.
Leave that's the TV true. Running.
I guess
leave it running for 9 months.
Yeah.
Yeah, if your parents were okay with that.
your CRT was okay with the burn-in.
For real. But I think that, like, has gotten more lopsided because the players have more tools to sort of break those mechanics that we've traditionally had.
Yeah.
But I also think developers don't, we haven't really established enough pacing tools to better establish that like relationship between mm-hmm. player and developer.
Yeah.
And so I think that we can't quite pace a game as well as we would like because there's just, we don't have that as vegetables.
So many inputs. It's so dynamic.
So many inputs. There's so many. Yeah. And it's very difficult to even control all of that.
But I like. Continue. Yeah. I like that we're talking about it explicitly as a layer because then it's a layer of stuff you can play with. Like, you know, you can't play with a thing that you don't know exists.
Yeah.
And you can't, like, paint with a color that you don't have in your palette.
Yeah.
And so when someone comes along, they're like, hey, pacing, that's blue. You can use blue now.
Yeah.
Like, it's just another thing you can think about.
Well, one of the things I think is a tool we do have as developers is we can be open and honest about the specifics, what we want from the player, because then they can approach it from their own terms and they can understand that.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know? Right.
So like
so they know when they're doing it in an unoptimal way, they can just make that choice and be happy with
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Yeah. At that point, it's just like, Hey players, we would like you to play it in this particular way. And you don't have to explicitly say play it for 3 hours, but like you could, you know, just make it kind of clear what the intention is. And you can do that through narrative or through mechanics.
Yeah.
Like you can make the narrative feel more urgent. Right, like you can make it feel like, oh, the world's gonna end if you don't do this thing, and players will be like, oh no, the world's gonna end if you don't do this thing. I think a lot of times people are like, actually, it's not gonna end. We've got all the time in the world, but like
that's its own problem.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, like that sense of urgency, even if it doesn't actually exist, can at least communicate to players that like, oh, I don't necessarily have to do this side content because like the main content is more important in this moment.
It's funny when you go to the casino in Paper Mario, Thousand Year Door, you go into one of the special games, and they give you access, and you play it, and they say, don't forget to rescue Princess Peach.
Yeah.
That's funny.
That is really funny.
It's like a comment on casinos as much as anything else.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
But I think that the ability to just, like, not just through narrative, but just in general, like, communicate to the player that this is the intention, and then, like, the player making that decision to, you know, not follow that if they don't want to, because like it's ultimately their game and they can do what they want. That's how it works.
Yep.
It gives them that presentation so they know what the developer wanted and maybe can understand a little bit why the developer wanted it, and then like can make that decision with more understanding, with more knowledge.
Yeah, that's positive reinforcement as opposed to negative reinforcement, right?
Yes.
If you don't do what the developer wants you to do when you play a Mario game, you fall in a pit and die.
Right.
That's negative reinforcement.
Yeah.
It's very effective.
Yeah.
but there was a game recently that did have like a title card. Like, this is a game that has these themes and works this way, and we recommend you do it this way.
Mm.
Like, and I remember thinking that was so heavy-handed.
Sure.
Like, can't the game do that?
Slap!
But like, I don't know, maybe the game can't do that.
Yeah.
Like, at least maybe that game couldn't. And certainly there's maybe a production issue late, and they found playtesters when they were told something like that enjoyed themselves. So they're like, well, it's too late to do anything other than mm-hmm. help people.
Mm.
So, you know, not damning it for that reason, but it does feel like it's kind of telling people like, this is an imperfect product. Here's additional instructions. If you know what I mean? Rather than
I'm not trying explicitly saying like the title card thing like you're saying. I'm not saying that even
trying to encourage them through sort of
positive
narrative
reinforcement
or,
like you were saying.
Yeah. And then when they don't do that, letting them get away with it and then not having no negative reinforcement.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, I'm not arguing against it exactly.
But you're saying there's limits to that.
Yeah.
Sure.
I think the idea of like, the idea of like reinforcing choices isn't, I'm not thinking of it really the same way. Like, I'm not really thinking of it as like, okay, you're going to move through the game at this pace and I'm going to reinforce that behavior for you. I think of reinforcement as, do you want that decision? You're using reinforcement to teach them the game system, and pacing is one of your systems.
Yes. Yeah.
And so you should give your player, you should help your player just like you help them, you know, learn the combat mechanics, help them learn the pacing mechanics. Mm-hmm. So when the character in the casino is like, don't forget to rescue Princess Peach. You know, I'm assuming they say that towards the entrance, right? And so they know, like, you know, okay, back to the main storyline is back this way, you know, like giving them, you know, helping them understand the systems of control that are available to them to modulate the pacing to their own extent and the limits of that. Like,
yeah.
So I think that's kind of how I'm thinking of it, as just another layer to the game system. It's just, you know, pacing is a system in your game too, unless you have a very linear game.
I think the difficulty with that, I think you're right, but I think the difficulty in that is that the whole point of pacing is it's temporal, right? Like, you can't, one event is not pacing, it needs to be multiples. And so if players, if they're doing it wrong, to say, right, then you actually have to let them do it wrong for a while before you even can know. I mean, systems vary.
Yeah.
I think it might be why this is so difficult.
Yeah.
And I think definitely that Princess Peach thing is less of a proper reminder and more of a, we know how these games are. A little bit more of an in-joke.
Rather than
a proper motivator.
Fair.
Yeah. And so another sort of thing that frustrates me is when games have that self-awareness. You see it all the time in really gritty third-person action games. You'll hear like an audio log that's just like total farce sketch comedy. And you're like, why is this in this game? And it's like, well, because they know you're not taking it seriously.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think that happens a lot. Sort of another sidebar, but I think that happens a lot in that there's definitely an acceptance of like, this is how games work. When we give people those freedoms, they'll abuse them. But they're enjoying themselves and it's fine and whatever.
Yeah.
I guess.
Kind of makes me want to go back and play the Stanley Parable and think about that game in terms of pacing.
Yeah.
Because that whole game is making fun of games.
Well, the thing about that game, and I'm not a huge fan, but it accounts for essentially every choice you can make.
Yeah.
And has, it's very incredibly crafted to the point where each of those is a properly paced experience.
Yes.
Because when you are wasting time, that is part of the story.
Right.
And so that becomes part of the, and then it's commented upon and stuff. And so, I mean, it's a bit of a trick the way they do it, but as little in that game as I would say is honest, that they come by that honestly, I think. So like, that's the praise I can give that. It's like, I think that the, and that's where you can have the sort of user story and the developer story can coexist, but it means you have to do a lot of developer story to account for all the user story. Right.
Yeah. It's a lot of effort. And it's difficult because, like, if you're making a game open world or something like that, how do you even control that?
And explicitly, you're designing something not to.
Right.
Yeah. So that you, I guess the question then is accepting and designing everything else around that loss of control.
Yeah.
Like, not trying to fight it. Like, this is what we want to do.
Yeah.
I guess I definitely just see too many games that don't recognize that they've lost that control.
Right.
Things people complain about all the time. Like, you go and start the main mission again, and they say, oh, great, you're here. Yesterday, I told you, and like, what? It was 3 months ago. Like, you know, like, I saved three, you know, boats of you know, flaming boats, and I toppled a neighboring government in the time since last night we snuck out of that building and met up at the rendezvous point. Like, there's just a sort of acceptance in a lot of games that, like, doesn't matter, whatever.
Right. Well, and I guess that's part of why I was thinking about it. Like, I do think that, like, we haven't developed, I think pacing tools exist for this, but I just don't know of them, and I don't know that we've developed enough tooling in order to, like, better calibrate these kinds of things, especially for open world games, but just in general. I think it's something that it kind of feels like a losing battle, because it sort of is a losing battle, because just, like, everything the society has changed in a way that like we can't quite combat. We haven't figured out how to combat.
I think as players and as developers, there are things we're not ready to give up.
Yes.
To make it all work.
Yeah.
We'll give up certain things, but then we don't accept the consequences of that. And we'll hold on to the other things that would naturally are no longer compatible with that.
Yeah.
Coming back to, this is maybe the last thought I have on this topic, but coming back to the idea of open world games, I think there's a temptation when you're building an open world, when you're thinking through like a design of something open world, maybe for the first time, that it's an environment, right? Like you're setting up an environment and it's going to have all these different like features, just like a natural environment does. The thing is like in a natural environment, you go walk through the woods, you might walk for 3 hours and not see anything interesting.
Yeah.
Especially if you don't know what you're doing because you're new to that environment, right? You don't know what to look for. So you're never making an environment. You're never setting up an environment. You're always making a garden, right? Like you are always in a constrained place and shaping the way that people are moving through it. Even if you give them 360 degree freedom rather than a path, you still think about what they're seeing in that 360 degree view. And this is what like the Breath of the Wild games did so well, that it still, you know, it was a cultivated experience, even though it felt so, I mean, and it was so vast.
Yeah.
They just still recognized it was a garden.
Yeah. By setting it after a calamity. I mean, there's some rebuilding in the sequel, but it allowed you to just goof off for a long time without breaking the immersion of the world.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that user story, the pacing of the user was more important and didn't fight the pacing of the proper story as much.
Yeah.
But they had to give up a lot to do that, right?
Yeah.
They less bustling, less urgency, you know, less narrative thrust.
Right.
Yeah.
But they did make that choice. And I would not, it's not perfect, but they did a better job, certainly.
Maybe everything is everything, but certainly in terms of your game design, you can't have your game be everything.
That's good. Know? Put that on a t-shirt.
That doesn't fit on a t-shirt. I think it's too long. Everything is everything except for the fact that when you try to dig a game, it can't be everything.
We'll workshop it. Okay.
This is, we have some really good topics today. Gosh, I will be thinking about these for quite some time.
Dude, I'm tired. My brain is tired.
I know, really intense thoughts. That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on social media at Nice Games Club, where Dale posts about game dev resources and science being for cats. It's always about cats. Reply on the various platforms or email us, contact@nicegames.club.
You say that like it's a problem.
It's not. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello.
And so, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.